Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 6th of June, these are our main stories. A Sudanese paramilitary commando whose forces are accused of killing more than 100 protesters has defended the crackdown. A former general who led a military coup in Thailand has been elected prime minister in a parliamentary vote that the opposition says was rigged. The Mexican authorities say they've dismantled three illegal laboratories used to produce tens of millions of dollars worth of methamphetamine. Also in this podcast,
London calling in the home, overseas and European services of the BBC, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
75 years ago today, more than 150,000 troops from Britain, America and Canada took part in the D-Day landings during the Second World War. The commander of a Sudanese paramilitary force, which is accused of shooting dead more than 100 protesters, has said the country must not be allowed to slip into chaos. Mohamed Hamad Dagalo, known as Hameti, is the deputy chief of Sudan's ruling military council. He appeared to defend the crackdown, saying the protests had been infiltrated by rogue elements. From Khartoum, Catherine Biarahanga reports.
Almost every hospital in Khartoum is still treating victims of the crackdown. As Ibrahim Malik, on the southern outskirts, patients are still coming in. Many of them have been shot. Now there are allegations from the Sudanese Doctors' Committee that at least 40 victims of the violence were thrown into the River Nile. It has led to widespread condemnation of the RSF militia, accused of being at the heart of the violence, and in particular their commander, the man they call Hameti. But today he made an extraordinary denial.
We've had rising numbers of martyrs, my brothers, but be in no doubt. They want our rapid support forces to be killed. These so-called protesters are actually gangs, and we can't let them succeed. And I warn the Sudanese people, there are vehicles in your neighbourhood disguised as the RSF. But be on the lookout, as they'll threaten and attack you.
That would be hard to take and even harder to believe for the hundreds of people who still lie in hospitals like Ibrahim Malik. They know who they blame for the violence, and those who are able are already heading back to the streets.
Catherine Biarahanga in Khartoum. So, where now for Sudan? I asked our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
We don't really know what the military is offering at the moment. We've had an extraordinary about turn, which seems to have come. Let's just wind back to Tuesday. Early on Tuesday, the head of the military council said that all the agreements that had been made with the opposition alliance were now null and void, and elections would happen in 9 months. What we think has happened since then, the American officials have been in touch with their Saudi allies, and that Saudi Arabia is a close ally as well of the military in Sudan. And a message has obviously gone from Saudi Arabia to say, no, this isn't going to do, and we're not happy with, you need to change the tune kind of thing. So then we've had an about turn, and the head of the military has apologised for what went on and said they're ready for talks. At the same time, his number two, who's a notorious commander of this paramilitary force, has kind of defended the clampdown, saying that there were rogue elements amongst the protesters and law and order has to be kept. So very mixed messages from the military. We don't know if there's a split in the military, and we don't know whether the decision to carry out that very brutal crackdown was taken by the whole of that military council or by individuals within it.
Will Ross. Following days of heavy rain in eastern Uganda, at least six people have been killed in flooding and landslides. Dozens of others are missing. Houses were swept away in several villages when the river Sume burst its banks. Dejan reports from Kampala.
The landslides occurred in Butebulo and Bunamwamba villages in Bwari sub-county at around 1 o'clock this morning after a three-day downpour. Local authorities estimate that hundreds have fled their homes and taken shelter in churches, mosques, or are with relatives. According to the government, over 100,000 people living in the area require urgent relocation. Bududa witnessed its worst landslides 9 years ago, in which more than 300 people were killed.
Dear Jean, in Uganda. The man who led a military coup in Thailand, the retired general Prayut Chan-o-cha, has been elected as the country's first civilian prime minister in 5 years. The opposition says the vote was rigged. I heard more about Parliament's decision from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow.
It was quite a long parliamentary session, longer than many people thought it would be. It was 12 hours, lots of speeches. In fact, Thailand has been under military rule for the last 5 years, so you can possibly understand why they took so long. These new members of parliament wanted to have their say. But in the end, they chose the ruling military leader, the former general Prayut Chan-o-cha, as the new civilian prime minister.
He was challenged, though, wasn't he?
He was challenged. He was challenged by a young politician, businessman, Thanathorn Jurunrangit. He did particularly well with his party, the Future Forward Party, a new party, appealed to younger people. But in the end, the parliamentary arithmetic was just against him. And it's worth exploring this in detail. There were two houses of parliament voting for the prime minister. In total, they had 750 votes. So the new prime minister had to get 376 to get elected to office. Well, when I tell you that the Senate, 250 votes, were entirely handpicked by Mr. Prayut himself, then you can see that the opposition really had little chance from the beginning. And even though there was an election in Thailand 2 months ago, the result of the election with such a parliamentary setup didn't really matter.
Now, Prayut seized power, didn't he, back in 2014. So would you say the country is still very divided?
It is. A lot of the fundamental problems that led to the military coup in the first place still haven't been resolved. If you look at the election, there were several large parties. They all got votes, but nobody took a majority. And so Mr. Prayut, even though he's prime minister, could face a lot of challenges in the House of Representatives from a very sizable opposition who will oppose everything he does. In fact, they even oppose the fact that he was able to get elected in the first place using all those Senate votes. So looking forward, it's difficult to see that the problems that have riven Thai politics are going to be resolved by this selection of a new prime minister.
Michael Bristow. 75 years ago today, on the 6th of June 1944, more than 150,000 troops from Britain, America and Canada took part in D-Day, an invasion of France by Allied forces as part of the process of ending the Second World War in Europe. They crossed the English Channel, landing in Normandy. The Allied invasion was codenamed Operation Neptune, aimed at pushing the Nazi regime out of occupied France. It was the largest amphibious assault in history.
Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye. Dealio, here I go on my way.
He either fears his fate too much, or his deserts are small, who dare not put it to the touch to win or lose it all. Good luck to each one of you, and good hunting on the mainland of Europe.
On the decks and in the holds, the soldiers were waiting. For the most part, standing about, looking out to sea, talking now and then, and thinking, wondering, waiting, and listening.
London calling in the home, overseas and European services of the BBC, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, have just issued communique number 1. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
Le quartier général du commandement suprême des forces expéditionnaires alliées.
This is the BBC Home Service. D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching.
The voice of the Allied commander, General Dwight Eisenhower, ending that montage. Well, Dan Damon spoke to the historian, Sir Anthony Beaver, about the invasion.
The danger today is we look back with 2020 hindsight and we cannot quite imagine how frightened or alarmed people were by the dangers facing this huge operation. Field Marshal Sir Alan Brooke considered that this could be the worst disaster of the whole war. Churchill was incredibly nervous. Group Captain Stagg, who was the chief meteorologist, had seen that there was this appalling depression which was developing over those first few days of June in the northwest Atlantic. But suddenly they found that there was actually going to be a break in the weather, enough of a break to be able to allow D-Day to go forward, not on the 5th of June as had been planned, but on the 6th of June.
Outline for us, if you were, Will, Sir Anthony, the plan. What was the plan?
The basic idea was to protect the flanks of the invasion zone, and the flanks being the Cotentin Peninsula, the Cherbourg Peninsula, on the right, on the western side, and then the valley of the River Dives on the eastern side, by dropping three divisions of paratroopers. And those would go off during the night and would be there in position in the early hours of the morning, by which time the naval forces would be in position to commence their bombardment. And they had been preceded by 277 minesweepers in line abreast. Now, Admiral Ramsay was terrified that these very fragile craft could be massacred, but the German Navy never put to sea that night because they had no idea that there was this break in the weather coming. So a huge stroke of luck there. And then, of course, once the bombardment by the warships was coming to an end, this is when the landing craft started going in. And, of course, the bombers were also trying to bomb the beaches. One of the reasons for bombing the beaches was to make big shell holes so that the troops could actually shelter in them if they were coming under fire. But at Omaha, the American bombers had held on for the last couple of seconds more, and that meant actually all the bombs fell inland. And so it became a completely futile operation there.
The Germans were so confident that the weather was too bad for the invasion that Erwin Rommel, the German commander, had actually gone home to his family, hadn't he?
He had indeed. He'd gone home for his wife's birthday. He'd even got her some Parisian shoes, which he was going to give her. Then he was going to go on to the Berghof to see Hitler to persuade him to allow him to have an extra panzer division for the defence of Normandy. But also within Normandy itself, many of the commanders were away because they thought that there was no chance of the invasion that day, were away from their command posts because they decided to have a map exercise down at Carentan. So many of them were actually caught in a very difficult position.
The historian Sir Anthony Beaver speaking there to Dan Damon. Now, here on Global News, we bring you the news that's happening right now. But what about the stories that are no longer in the news? Well, that's where the Witness History podcast comes in. 5 days a week, the team bring you history told by the people who were there. Recently, we've heard from the student leader whose life was changed by his involvement in the Tiananmen Square protests and the first black woman to write a Broadway show. The Witness History gives you a sense of how the news stories of today can have a real-life impact on the futures of the people involved. Just search for Witness History wherever you find this podcast. The Mexican security forces have dismantled three synthetic drugs labs in the northern state of Sinaloa. The authorities also seized 17 million doses of methamphetamine. Here's Leonardo Rocha.
A senior Sinaloa government official, Cristobal Castañeda, said this was the biggest blow to meth production in Mexico this year. 20 illegal labs have been destroyed in the state so far in 2019. They've been located by new drones used by the army, which can capture heat waves in remote areas. Most of the illegal drugs are smuggled into the United States. The operation shows, however, that the Sinaloa cartel continues to produce vast amounts of meth, heroin, cocaine and fentanyl, despite the arrest and extradition of its founder, Joaquin Guzman, known as El Chapo.
Leonardo Rocha. There's been outrage in Australia after police raided the headquarters of the public broadcaster ABC over suspicions that it had published classified material. ABC said the search on Wednesday was in relation to broadcasts made in 2017 about alleged misconduct of Australian troops in Afghanistan. The head of investigative journalism, John Lyons, called the raid a violation and a savage attack on the media. The BBC called it highly worrying at a time when the media is becoming less free across the world. A public broadcaster was being targeted, it said, for reporting in the public interest. Well, it comes a day after Australian police raided the home of a newspaper journalist, Annika Smethurst, again over allegations of publishing classified information. Raza Iqbal spoke to Craig McMurtry, ABC's editorial director, and began by asking him about the scope of the investigation being conducted by the Australian Federal Police.
So it goes to stories that we filed called the Afghan Files some 2 years ago. Two of my colleagues, Dan Oak, Sam Clark, very fine reporters, revealed concerns in defence about allegations of misconduct of special forces in Afghanistan. And so the warrant wants to look at any classified materials and names those two journalists, but also the director of news at the ABC, Gavin Morris.
This was a story about alleged misconduct of Australian troops in Afghanistan. Can you outline the details for us?
So essentially what it went to was suggestions of unlawful killings by elite soldiers in Afghanistan. And it went to concerns within defence about the culture of elite soldiers and the conduct of elite soldiers and whether or not there had been some unlawful killings in their operations in Afghanistan.
What do you think has been the catalyst for this? The stories were published in 2017.
Well, that is interesting, and that's a question really only the Federal Police can answer. It is quite extraordinary that 2 years has passed. I don't know why precisely the raid has been timed for now. The interesting thing, I suppose, is in a suite of changes in legislation last year, a public interest defence for journalists, it made it effectively an offence to deal in classified material, but there was a public interest defence for journalists added. But of course, when the Afghan Files reporting was happening, that change in legislation wasn't in place.
And what did the police do at the offices of ABC? What do they take?
We're still in negotiation with them right now. So essentially what happened was they arrived this morning. When we use the word raid, it rather implies doors being kicked in and whatnot. It wasn't like that. They arrived in suits. They were perfectly pleasant and polite. But it's the chilling effect of it, really. It is extremely unusual for a warrant like this to be issued on Australia's national public broadcaster. And they entered the building. They have been able to go through files, reports, electronic messages, etc. And then there is a negotiation, I suppose, a discussion. Our lawyers have been following them all the time over what exactly is removed.
And the warrants were issued without any prior knowledge of the Home Affairs Department. The Minister, Peter Dutton, says that he had no prior knowledge of any of this.
Yes, the Minister's saying that the agency, in this case the Federal Police, acts independently in these matters and he was unaware of it.
What's your reflection as you think about the impact of this?
It's extremely disconcerting. Whatever the intent behind it, whatever the purpose behind it, it sends a clear signal. It's interesting that another journalist, not an ABC journalist, home, her private residence, was subject to another raid by authorities only yesterday.
This was a News Corp journalist, Annika Smethurst.
That's correct. And it was on an unrelated matter, but another unusual one. It's not the Australia that I'm used to. That's why it is so very disconcerting. Free speech is fundamental in this functioning democracy, and we believe certainly that we acted lawfully and that the journalism, whilst it dealt with difficult and challenging subject matter, was certainly in the public interest. So that's the great concern out of all of this, that somehow it has a chilling effect on journalists. But I should also say that the other concern is, of course, for sources and whistleblowers, the message it sends them. I mean, my colleagues here at the ABC, we're a large organisation. They have our support, of course. But for potential, you know, whistleblowers and sources out there, it is an entirely different matter.
Craig McMurtry, ABC's editorial director. On Wednesday, we reported the tragic story of a 17-year-old girl who is understood to have ended her life with euthanasia in the Netherlands. Noa Potthoven was suffering from post-traumatic stress, depression and anorexia. Now it's being reported that she had been allowed to die at her own home but wasn't helped to die. Evan Davis heard more from our correspondent in the Netherlands, Anna Holligan, who's in The Hague.
So Noa Potthoven, young, physically fit, but psychologically clearly struggling. At the age of 11, she was sexually assaulted at a school party. 3 years later, she was raped by two men. Back then, fear and shame kept her silent, but her pain manifested itself in things like PTSD, depression and eating disorders. And we know this because eventually she turned her teenage diary into an autobiography, which she published to try to break down the taboos and improve support for young people who'd suffered similar trauma. But while she talked about improving the life of others, hers continued to deteriorate until eventually she decided she couldn't go on. So in her last post, she wrote on Instagram, "After years of battling and fighting, I'm drained. I've quit eating and drinking for a while now, and after many discussions and evaluations, it was decided to let me go because my suffering is unbearable. Out of fear and shame, I relive the fear and that pain every day, always scared, always on my guard, and to this day my body still feels dirty. My house has been broken into, my body that can never be undone."
Right. Now, this has been reported in many parts of the world's media as a case of euthanasia, but that's a misinterpretation. How did that come about?
All over the world. If you were being generous, you could say it was lost in translation. So we do know that she had inquired about euthanasia. She's talked about this in the past. She visited the end-of-life clinic here in The Hague. But I think it's a combination of the fact that she did visit the clinic and various foreign media especially failing to actually check the facts. So the clinic has actually put out a statement saying, "To put an end to the incorrect reporting in foreign media in particular about her death, we refer to the statement made by friends of Noa this afternoon. Noa Potthoven did not die of euthanasia, they say. To stop her suffering, she stopped eating and drinking. The end-of-life clinic deals exclusively with euthanasia." So she wasn't given that lethal cocktail of drugs that are provided here in the Netherlands when someone has been granted the right to die through euthanasia, but rather she'd gone on this hunger strike. She was being fed through a tube, and eventually the doctors and her family accepted her wish to die. So they stopped forcing her to stay alive, and instead they provided a kind of palliative care to make her final days at home in Arnhem as peaceful and bearable as possible. And she died at her family home in the early hours of Sunday morning. And that was confirmed by her sister, Isa, in another Instagram post.
Anna Holligan in the Netherlands. Now, as we heard earlier, 75 years ago today, on the 6th of June 1944, more than 150,000 troops from Britain, America and Canada took part in D-Day, an invasion of France by Allied forces as part of the process of ending the Second World War in Europe. It was the largest amphibious assault in history. So, what was the event like for civilians living in Normandy? Well, Emma-Jane Kirby spoke to Thérèse Le Chevalier, who lived at the time in a village opposite Juno Beach and was liberated that very first day of Operation Overlord.
My name is Thérèse. I was born in 1929, so I'm 90.
Thérèse Le Chevalier, Lee Le Sueur, was a 15-year-old boarding school pupil back in 1944. But on the Whitsuntide holidays that year, her mother ordered her to come back home to Bernier-sur-Mer. A cousin working in the resistance had suggested that something big was about to happen on the Normandy coast.
We woke at midnight, my father, my mother, my sister and I, on the 6th of June, of course, with a horrible din. Well, the boats on the sea were shelling the place, indeed. For the whole night, we were in the far end of our yard, and my father was wise enough to dig out a trench. So we were hidden in the trench until 6 o'clock. And at 6 o'clock, suddenly, everything stopped. We came out of our bunker in sort, wondering what we could see. And what we saw was absolutely amazing. All the soldiers, there were the Canadians first, some with black faces in order not to be spotted. And they were all wet, of course, because they had walked through into the sea in order to land. And we pitied them, those poor things. And of course, there were all sorts of weapons coming by, tanks and jeeps. Well, all the people in the village were out, and so happy, because, of course, first of all, we were liberated indeed. We felt free, but we were alive. That was a wonderful, absolutely wonderful day for the feeling of life.
90-year-old Thérèse Le Chevalier, who witnessed the D-Day operation in Normandy on the 6th of June 1944. And our thanks to the Juno Beach Museum in Normandy for their help with that report.
When the lights go on again, all over the world.
And 75 years on from D-Day, that's it from us for now. But there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I leave you with Vera Lynn singing the wartime song, When the Lights Go On Again. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, goodbye.